The following is an interview with Mr. Charles Olive. This interview is being conducted by Laura Birch in Mr. Olive's office located at 22 North Main Street in Statesboro, Georgia, on May 18th, 1996.
Okay. Well, Laura, as I stated, this is certainly unrehearsed and unplanned because I didn't know exactly what you wanted of me. But since you said you would like to start with where my grandparents were born and going up through my life, my great-grandfather was Charles Pretorius, and he was born in Mainz, Germany, and married Mary Little. And he came to the United States, I don't remember the exact date, but he was a young person and landed in New York and worked his way down the East Coast looking for a place he would like to settle. And he finally decided to settle here in Bullock County. And the schools were such in this area that he wasn't particularly pleased with what he saw for his children. So he bought some acreage down in the area of Brunswick. And he would spend the school years down there with his children, with his wife, and back up here during the rest of the year. Charles Pretorius had a number of children, one of whom was my grandmother on my father's side, Josie Missouri Pretorius. And then on my mother's side, well, maybe I better stay with my daddy's side for a while. He was the only boy in his family, and he had three sisters. One was the wife, or became the wife, of the person who started the Statesboro Telephone Company here in Statesboro, Mr. Jim Matthews. And the other married an attorney in Savannah, John Kennedy, who later became mayor of Savannah. And he had two sisters rather than three. Then my daddy was the only boy in the family. So his father died at an early age. He was about, my daddy at that time was about 26 years old, I think. And my grandfather had acquired a lot of land. He was more of a horse trader. He bought from the Courthouse Square here in Statesboro out to where Mr. Lloyd Waters' place is, which is about 1,300 acres. And the reason he was able to buy that, there were two neighbors, one across the street from one another, right back of where was the first building back of the courthouse coming north. And one day, this man saw my daddy, my granddaddy, on the street, and he said, Solly, his name was Solly Olive, Solly Franklin Olive, said, I want to sell you this land. And my granddaddy told him, you know, I don't have the money to buy this land. He says, you don't need any money. He says, I'll sell it to you for $1,500 and give you X number of years to pay for it. So my granddaddy bought it. And the reason he wanted to sell it, he didn't like his neighbor across the street. And he said he was not going to live that close to somebody he didn't like. So the paper the next day carried an article about my granddaddy, Solly Olive, being taken in a deal. And of course, it was one of the smartest purchases he ever made because the land just kept getting more valuable and more valuable. And there's still some of that land in his name, in his estate. This S.F. Olive estate here in Statesboro that hasn't been sold, nor has it been divided. Then my daddy kept the estate together during the Depression when there wasn't any money. The banks closed because of lack of profits and loans that had gone sour. And my daddy and Mr. Alfred Dorman, I'm sure you've heard that name here in Statesboro, spent something like a year and a half. They were directors of the bank. My granddaddy had helped form the bank, the Sea Island Bank, when it was chartered in 1901. And at his death, my daddy took his seat on the board. And after the bank closed, Mr. Dorman and my daddy spent numerous hours going from Statesboro to Atlanta to talk with the banking department about reopening the Sea Island Bank. And after about 18 months, they were successful in doing that. And daddy was made president of the bank. And he remained president and chairman of the board for some 35 years after. Banking at that time was entirely different from what it is today. If you owned stock in a bank and the bank was closed because, as the term was used, it went busted and closed, you had to lose your value in the stock, plus you had to pay into the bank the par value of the stock of that which you held. So you had a double loss. But the Sea Island Bank paid back every dime to every stockholder they had. And from that time on, it has gone forward, and today it's earning in the neighborhood of $3.5 to $4 million a year. So it's been quite successful over the years. About my mother's side, my mother was born in Davisburg, Georgia. And at the age of 2, her mother and daddy, Mr. and Mrs. Ed L. Smith, and my mother's name, my grandmother's name, was Mary Smith. They moved to Statesboro. And Mama lived here in Statesboro for almost 96 years. She lived to be 95 years. She lived to be 97 years old. You know where the First Methodist Church is in Statesboro? Where the Chamber of Commerce is now, that house was built by my grandfather, Ed L. Smith, and later was occupied by one of his sons, Harry Smith, who owned and operated H.W. Smith Jewelers. That was my mother's brother. Well, after my Uncle Harry's death, the Chamber of Commerce purchased this and renovated the property to be suitable for a Chamber of Commerce greeting people who were interested in moving to Statesboro. My granddaddy and my daddy were in the feed and seed and grain business. You know where the parking lot is right back of the Sea Island Bank? Mm-hmm. That's where the feed and seed and grain business was. And right across the street, where H.W. Smith Jewelers is now, that's where the grocery and market business were. And my granddaddy and my daddy were in business together. And at my granddaddy's death, on my mother's side, my daddy bought businesses out from the estate and continued to operate it until we got out of the room. He liquidated them in late 50s, I believe. But it had been in business since 1897. Now, you wanted to know something about how the Depression of the 30s affected the lives of people.
Yes, tell me just a little about, first of all, Statesboro as a whole and how it was affected by the Great Depression.
Well, I would have to be, I think, completely general in that because I couldn't be specific, not knowing the different effects that it had on different families. But I know on my family side, my daddy was like a lot of other people. He owed money in business to make the business expand and whatnot. He had land to where he could borrow money. But he paid interest on top of interest and on top of interest. Banks back at that time, those that stayed open would make less than $2,000 a year. The families that existed in the Statesboro then became families that would watch what they had to have and buy only that, except those few families that had cash. The cash just wasn't available. People from the county would come into the stores in Statesboro, the food stores, and they would bring chickens, they would bring sides of smoked meat that they had killed and cured themselves, and the owners of the store would buy that meat, and then they would give them hard staple goods, grits, flour, lard, coffee, tea and things like that, sugar. The value that they had brought in meats and chickens and eggs, they would give them that value back in hard staple goods that they could take home and live on. And that was the way people, or it was a bartering situation. And that's the way people lived. I remember the morning at breakfast, my daddy being a director of the bank. Of course, he knew it wasn't going to open the day that we had breakfast. And he told us at the breakfast table, the Sea Island Bank is not going to be open for business anymore. And that was almost like a death in the family, because you didn't know where money was coming from. To buy anything from, to pay a doctor. You just didn't know where it was coming from. What monies that were in the banks at that time was frozen. You couldn't get it out. I know my daddy told me what a difficult task it was due. He had a little money in the personal checking account and in two business checking accounts. And he could have pulled that money out the last day that the bank was open. But that wouldn't have been quite proper for him to have done that. And he left that money in there knowing that he couldn't get it out, and he didn't have any money. And that was not something that just affected one family. It was a family after family after family, and a lot of businesses closed. There just wasn't money to carry on business. But people had faith. There had been depressions before, and people had faith that this was a good area, and that it was a matter of riding out the storm, and then good times would be there again.
Well, you mentioned that there had been depressions before. Did people at this point, did they seem to think that this was going to become the Great Depression, that it was going to be so much, or become so, such a part of American history, or did they just think this was just one more in a line?
Laura, I can't answer that. I really don't know, and I don't know that they had any yardstick to measure that by. It was a gradual thing, and then it seeded out at the bottom, and then it continued on. And you know what happened on Wall Street. People were committing suicide, jumping out of windows. That none of that happened around here. It was mostly people that were really in the money market that had been so speculative with investments, until it just caused them to know that in their mind they could never recover from it. But as far as anyone taking their life in this area, no, I don't know anything like that would happen.
Okay, well, tell me a little bit about school during this time. Were more children being forced to stay at home to help out, since not as much money was coming in, or were they still going to school? What was that like?
Well, that which I have some knowledge of, the schools at that time, the grade schools here in Statesboro and the high school, all of the books, the textbooks, were furnished by the state. I beg your pardon. At that time, people were buying their books. In fact, my daddy's store sold all the books for the school here in Statesboro. That was the only place that sold them. And in place of people coming in and buying new books, they would get the used books of the class preceding them and use those books on down the road. College, I graduated from high school in 35. And I remember very distinctly, my freshman year was at Georgia Southern, And my daddy told me after that 1 year, I wanted to go to Jones Business College in Atlanta where he had gone when he finished high school. And he said, I want you to go to a 4-year college. So I entered Georgia Southern, and he told me at the end of that year, I thought I was still in high school, so let's go to Athens and enter the University of Georgia. He took me up there and introduced me to a Dr. Wynn, who was a druggist. And he says, if a boy gets in trouble, says, help him out. And he gave me $15 a month spending money. That was my spending allowance, $15 a month. I thought it was really a small amount, but at that time it was a lot of money. As far as people that lived in the county helping their family with the crops, the gathering of the crops, a lot of children at that time, we were talking about nine months of schooling, probably got to attend class 7 months or 7.5 months. The rest of the time they were helping their families. And consequently, it caused some people to be a year and a half to 2 years older when they graduated because of having helped their families and staying out. They couldn't keep up with what was going on in class.
Well, when you went to college, did you think that less people were going to college? And what was it actually like being in college when, like, job markets were so down, banks were closed, and so many people were, in so much financial trouble? What was that like?
Well, Laura, I don't know. I can't speak for the other people, but I felt like I was being given the opportunity to learn that everybody didn't have that opportunity, that my mother and daddy were actually sacrificing to send me to school. And frankly, I didn't care to go to the University of Georgia. I didn't care to go to Georgia Southern. I wanted to go to Jones Business College, do what my daddy had done, get out and go to work. Doing what? I don't know. But I quit my senior year and went to Jones Business College. My daddy told me, if you don't have enough knowledge or sense to know that you ought to go and get your degree, go ahead to Jones. And that's what I did. And I've regretted it ever since. But I made the decision and I stuck with it.
Well, when you were finished with school, what was it like finding a job? Did you immediately come back to Statesboro for that? Or
I did.
Stay around Atlanta?
I knew that my daddy needed me in his business. And I knew I didn't like the business, but I felt that I was due him that courtesy of coming back and trying. He didn't know that I didn't like it. But he had exposed me to an education, whether I had absorbed it or not. So I came back and worked with him about 2 years. And I told my mama one day, sitting on the porch in the afternoon after I'd gone home, that I really and truly hated to get up and go to work. And she said, tell your daddy that he doesn't want you to stay if you don't like it. And she said, what do you want to do? And I had a friend, W.W. Woodcock, who had an automobile finance business tied in with his general insurance business. I said, I want to go to Will and talk him into teaching me that business and letting me open a branch office. And that's what I did.
Well, we've talked a lot about the business in school. What about in leisure time? What kind of differences were there?
At what period in your life?
All the way through, from being in school and if you had spare time in college. And we'll just start with that.
Well, as young people growing up in grade school, you made your own games. You didn't have a lot of games that were being invented by people, manufacturers and marketing. You made your own games. You played baseball, you played half rubber. You don't know what that is, do you? Cut a rubber ball in half and sail it and use a broomstick to hit it with. And it was difficult to do, but it taught you good coordination. Corn cob fights, you don't know what that is, do you? You used to take corn, shell all the corn off of it, and you'd have a cob left. soak those in water where they'd be real hard and go into a barn and choose up sides. And then you'd throw them at one another, from upstairs or downstairs. And I hit a guy one day with his head stuck out of the loft upstairs, and he fell to the ground. We never did have any more of those. But in high school, you would play basketball and baseball and football for the 4 years. I had no coordination to speak of, and consequently my basketball was very poor. I went out for 4 years, and the last 5 minutes of the last game of basketball, the coach sent me in as a courtesy to me. And I was so excited until I forgot to report to the referee, and they called a foul on me. I played football for 3 years because it needed some weight in the line, and I was something to make a hole become smaller, so I did that. In college, we used to go to the YMCA gym and work out and swim year-round. And I made the mistake of learning how to shoot snooker. You don't know what snooker is, do you? Do you know what it is, Jason?
No.
It's a game similar to pool, except that it requires a lot more skill. The pockets are smaller and the ball's a little smaller, and you had to be very exact with it. And I spent entirely too much time doing that, and not at the library where I should have been. But from early childhood, you made your own games. For my generation, you didn't have recreational apartments, you didn't have supervised play, and I think, frankly, Laura, that's what this generation and future generations need more of. Children are supervised so close today until they can't exercise the abilities that they have stored within them. They can't reach out. They are following a plan that has been made by adults. And I don't say they're bad, but children need some time of their own to dream about what they would like to do. Cut out paper dolls. Girls used to do that all the time and make books. My children have some at home now. They're in their 40s. My son in his 50s. But they learned how to do things themselves. And not all of it regimented.
So, what about as you got older and after you were finished with your college and you came back here, what kind of leisure activities were there then?
Mostly golf. I've been trying to learn how to play golf since I was about 17 years old, and I'm still trying to learn. You don't conquer that game.
It's a hard one.
Well, one day you'll go out there and you'll have a beautiful game. Everything works just right. And the next time you go out to play, you had it in your mind all that day when you were going out that afternoon, you're going to tear that course up. And after the third hole, you couldn't wait to get through and get off of that golf course. And the same thing happens to professional golfers. They'll win a fine tournament this weekend. And next week, they'll go somewhere and they can't even make the cut to enter into the final rounds. It just is a game you do not conquer. And that's what I spent most of my time doing, and with my family.
Okay, well, let's go back to when you were planning to leave your father's business and open up a branch. How well did that work? How did you feel about leaving that and trying something so new, and how successful were you at it?
Well, I knew that I didn't like what I was doing, and I think any young person, if they find out they don't like something, as quickly as they can move from that which they're unhappy with, the better off it'll be for them and the business. It took me about 2 months to sell Mr. Woodcock on the idea because he didn't have any branches. After that period of time, he said, all right, we'll do it. So I told my daddy, and he had talked with my dad in the meantime to see if it was all right with him for me to leave. And of course, daddy told him yes. So I followed Mr. Woodcock around, everything that he did, for about 3 months. And then I went to Vidalia, Georgia, and opened a branch office. And I worked Swainsboro and Vidalia, Claxton, Glenville, all of the towns within a 35 or 40 mile radius, calling on the automobile dealers to show them that the Georgia Motor Finance Company was a place for them to be financing their automobiles. And I worked at that for possibly over 9 months or a year. And one afternoon I came back to Statesboro and I told Mr. Woodcock I wanted to talk with him. And what I had made my mind up, I wanted to come back to Statesboro to live and that I could work the areas that I had built up this business just on a weekly basis. And we went in his office and I said, Will, I'm going to talk to you about something pertaining to the business. He said, you want me to tell you what it is? And I said, yes, I'd like it. And he told me exactly what I had in my mind. And we closed the office in Vidalia and I continued to build the business, but being a loan officer in his business here in Statesboro. And then the war came on and I left.
Well, we've talked about the closing of Sea Island Bank and how traumatic that was. What was it like when it reopened again?
Celebration. And then each year when the monies that had been lost by the depositors were paid back in percentage over a period of years, it just created that much more strength within the bank. And each depositor got every dime of his money back over a period of years, and I don't remember how many years it took. And of course, the stock continued to climb.
Well, let me ask you something. It's a little different. It is often said people of your generation have been responsible for some of the most prosperous times in the United States. I mean, y'all went from things like the Great Depression and World War II and have turned it around and done very well for yourselves as a whole. What do you think makes your generation so unique and so special?
Laura, I don't know that it is unique or special, really. Technology has made so much progress in the last 10 years until my generation is actually somewhat afraid of that right there. I don't think we've seen anything in technology advancement in the past compared to what we're going to see in the future. But what it takes away from what I feel is important is individuality. You become numbers. Wherever you go today, you're a number. When, up until the time when, 10 years after World War II and after the World Depression, you could go in any store in this town, had you lived here for a reasonable length of time, people would call you by your name, Laura or Jason, and they would know who your mother and father were. You go into any store in this town now, and if somebody happens to call you by name, it's very unusual. That to me is an important thing. And not only to me, but people in my generation. You go into a food store today to buy food. The first thing you do when you go to the checkout counter is pull out your identification for the check you're going to give. And I can understand why. But used to, all you did was charge it. When my daddy died at the age of 77, my mother was 76. She had never written a check in her life. She went to Savannah, she went to Atlanta, she went to any store in Statesboro, and when she made her purchases, She said, "Would you charge it, please?" There was no charge card. At the end of the month, my daddy got a bill and he paid. She couldn't even write a check. She had to learn how to write a check. So what we are living today takes all that individuality and closeness between people away. Can you tell me, prior to living in Statesboro, you were living in a metropolitan area, weren't you? Could you tell me every neighbor's name around you? That's what I'm talking about. I can't tell you who lives across the street from me right now, and I've been living there 35 years. Now, the neighbor hasn't been living there that long. I blow the horn and speak to him as I drive out on the drive. But that's no good. I'm trying to sell you on an idea now. We need more closeness within our families. When you left home, did you and Jason... Now, where does that put us as a world? As far as Christianity, I don't think God meant for us to live that way.
Well, let me ask you, during the Great Depression, when things got so bad, do you think that the community pulled together more?
Absolutely.
Do you think that made it so much easier for these other people?
You mean that were in real hardship?
The ones that were really bad off during this time.
That it made them easier for them?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, because families gave to one another. They gave to one another. And if they had a fire in the home, families then saw that that family was taken care of. And of course, we have highly organized entities today that do that, Red Cross being one, but that's not like a neighbor doing it.
So you feel that just the community pulling together, would you say that you feel that that's what pulled everybody through that and just keeping faith?
I think that's what pulled the nation through, is the closeness of enough people to make it happen. Along with the right people doing the right things, particularly in government and big business, to make things happen. Because things don't happen by themselves, people make them happen through actions.
Well, we've mentioned faith. From what I've always understood, people back prior to the Great Depression and during it were probably more church-going than they are
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely.
Did that change at all during that time? I mean, did more people go than normal? Or
no, I can't answer that. I know I wouldn't be able to answer that. I know it did not change our habits of Sunday school and church. The churches continued to grow, but a little at the time, because the population of this town was probably 6,000 or 7,000 inhabitants about the time of the Depression. No, I didn't see any change in it, but I'm sure it changed a lot of people. Some you could observe and some you couldn't, because your closeness with God is a personal thing.
You mentioned the population. Would you think that here in Statesboro, I've heard it said that quite a bit, like that during the Great Depression, people moved out of more rural places to go to bigger cities, looking for industrial jobs, trying to get away from farms or just small towns in general that were hurt. Did you notice that much in Statesboro?
It wasn't really noticeable. Because this was, see, primarily an agriculture, a farming area during that time. We didn't have any industry down here to speak of. It was primarily farming. And on the farm, you didn't have all this mechanization that you have today. It was done by hand. And consequently, the family members were needed to plant and to harvest. where you take a 10-row tractor out today and break 100 acres in about the length of time it took General Scott to fly from Warner Robins to Savannah. It would take a one-horse plow days to break that much ground. And the people were needed. That's the reason some had to leave school during the school term to help on the farm with planting and with harvest.
So the people here, they chose to remain here with their families where they were needed?
Well, some left, of course. If they were just fed up to the brim with the type of farming life that they had, then they would leave and go to a city where they could hopefully get a job in some industry.
Well, let me kind of shift gears here a little bit. It seems like really not long after coming out of the Depression is when people started taking notice of things going on in Europe, in particular Germany,
mm-hmm.
like invading Poland and such. When that started happening, were people still, did they care much at that point? Or were they still more concerned with what's going on here and building up again, trying to recover what they had lost?
Concerned what was here and what they'd lost and trying to recover.
Well, at what point do you think it was realized by people that what was happening in Europe would be something that the United States would get so involved with? Was it prior to Pearl Harbor, or did people realize that even before?
Laura, I'm sorry I can't answer that. I think the international relationships at one time there was very little of that involved in the everyday life of a small community. It was mostly involving cities. And never having lived in a city, I've read the Wall Street Journal for 38 years. But I think most international activity was thought about and carried on in metropolitan areas. And in small communities, you just didn't hear too much about it. But the way it is today, it's entirely different. People in this town are buying equities in foreign countries on a daily basis. And has been going on for a number of years. But that's only in recent years that type of activity has been going on. I don't know that I'm qualified to even try to answer that question.
Oh, I would think you would be. Well, here in Statesboro, and really I guess the surrounding areas, when we started coming involved, were people, even at that point, were they really that much into it, or were they still just concerned about what's going on here?
You mean international investments and things of that nature? Or
just like when World War II began and we started to become involved, were they interested, or were they still just concerned in this area?
Well, you know, the movement of Hitler was one that had been going on for years before the United States became involved in World War II. And our government and people sat still and let them take over one small country right after another, knowing full well that if you looked at the entire picture, what you could expect, they wanted to take over the world. So complacency, I would think, played too much of a part in allowing a person like Hitler to continue. If he had been stopped when he first started, then I don't think we would have experienced what we did in World War II. While Hitler was doing his thing in these small countries, the United States marching soldiers were using broomsticks instead of rifles because they didn't have rifles. And that's what the United States started with when World War II broke out, because of Pearl Harbor. And they knew about Pearl Harbor before it happened, if history books are correct.
Well,
I didn't answer your question, did I?
No,
you certainly do not want to experience them again. And I think the federal government, even though they're too much involved in everyday life of people now in the United States, I don't think they will ever let one happen again, because they'll start the money presses in Washington again and make the dollar worth even less than it is today. You know, people that were worth $1 million back, even at World War II level, they were considered very, very, very few in number. And today, there are people becoming millionaires every day, because that dollar is certainly not worth what it was then. And I hope they won't start the money presses again. I hope they'll let us go through some tough times until we can get this government in a condition not operating at the deficits we are now. We can't continue this. There's no way, and I know y'all feel that way too. And I'm so old until it won't affect me a lot, but it will certainly affect y'all's lives.
Well, let me answer something else. What do you think that the government could have done to change the threat question? Or do you think what they did in just letting people work it out for themselves was the best? Do you think they could have done anything better? Or just kept it the way they did?
Laura, I don't know, but the government today could get the greed out of our elected representatives and put some common thinking into what this country needs and the people of this country, what they need. And I think they can get it back on a basis that we can continue to operate as a strong country. We can't go on like we're now. We used to be a creditor nation. Now we're the biggest debtor nation there is. And that's because the people in Washington have given money away faster than we as taxpayers could send it up there. And they have to borrow money from foreign countries like Japan in order to get enough money to pay the interest on the loans that they already owe.
So you feel that looking back, how the government did it before, and not printing more money and not making things so much easier for people and having them work for it more is better than now, and we really do give it away.
Absolutely. And they have plans whereby it pays a person not to work. And then, and this is not something nice to get into, but it's a fact, the government pays the mother of illegitimate children for each child that she bears. And a lot of them are using that to bring in money to the house. And it's taking place today.
Well, let me ask you something kind of on those lines there. Obviously, during the Depression, when some people were worse off than others, and they needed more help than others, I have read that these people, in many cases, not so much that they were ashamed to take help, but they had so much pride that they really did not just want to be given things. Did you think in that time that was accurate?
Yes. you see people today in a food store in particular go to the counter and they have a food cart completely loaded and piled high, and they're paying every bit of them with food stamps. And I bet if you got to the bottom of it, they're drawing other monies from the federal government in addition to those food stamps, and it doesn't seem to bother them one particle. There was more pride in doing things yourself than exists today.
Do you think that the pride then was one of the things that really helped people and made them want to work more?
Now, I don't mean a self-pride, if you understand what I say, a pride beyond what it should be, and I don't know the correct words to describe it. But you enjoy giving people things. And if you're a proper recipient, you enjoy receiving from a person, but that's just a gift. But for them to give you a way of life, back in those days, wasn't a desirable thing. For instance, bankruptcies that are permitted today, and actually there are some lawyers who advertise, come on, see us, we'll handle a bankruptcy for you. And the client hasn't even said anything about it. He's planting ideas in that person's head to walk away from the debt or debts that he's created and start off anew. In my generation, if a person went bankrupt, they were tainted. The reputation was tainted. And they were ashamed of it. And rightfully so. But if they pulled themselves out of it, then they became stronger people. But bankruptcy today, it doesn't bother people. And that's the difference in what you're talking about.
Well, are there any other things
that
you'd like to add?
As I told you, your dad just asked me to sit still and she would come and want to talk to me, and I didn't know exactly what you wanted to talk about, Laura. I hope I've been helpful to you, but it was something that was strictly unrehearsed, as you know.
Well, I thank you very much for doing this, and I think you did very well. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.